brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is The Guardian.
Every time parliaments have acted on trying to regulate, particularly in the technology space, it quickly gets out of date because how fast the world transitions. And that's not an excuse for not doing anything.
Hi, I'm Karen Middleton, Guardian Australia's political editor, coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. Today on the Australian Politics podcast, I'm speaking with Greens Senator for South Australia, Sarah Hanson-Young. This week, it's the government versus Elon Musk, owner of the social media platform X. Free speech, social responsibility, and a legal showdown over violent content online. There are demands for better regulation, but can Australia be the world's internet police? A series of high-profile deaths have renewed the focus on violence against women, with rallies around the country, and the makers of MasterChef are claiming green credentials for using biomethane gas in their new season. Greenwashing or just the energy transition? Let's see what the Senator makes of it all. Senator Hanson-Young, thanks for joining us on the Australian Politics podcast.
It's great to be here, Karen. Thank you.
There's a lot that's been going on this week that's in your bailiwick. Politically speaking, can we start with social media and the big fight we're having with Elon Musk? We've seen him resisting the demands the Australian government has been making, particularly about taking down a violent video of an incident that occurred in Sydney a week or so ago. He's pushing back and saying, you know, you can't police the entire world internet. And we saw Peter Dutton make a similar point in the last few days. Do they have a point? Are we trying to sort of hold back the ocean? Are we trying to police the whole world? And is that just unrealistic?
Mm. Look, it's been quite an interesting debate to see explode over the last week. I think, people are rightly frustrated and angry that, you know, a big tech tycoon like Elon Musk can, you know, it feels like he can pick and choose and call, you know, Australian ministers and independent regulators names and, you know, effectively give the Australian government the middle finger. I mean, I think this is probably more about his ego than much else. However, it has created and brought to the front a broader conversation, and conversation we really need to have, because for far too long, big tech platforms, particularly in the social media space, have grown and grown and grown. They have millions of users now with very little, if no, regulation. And that's a key point. And the tech companies right around the world know this. They know governments are increasingly frustrated. There have been changes elsewhere around the world. Australia has implemented some here. The EU has recently introduced a digital act that starts to regulate social media companies. So the big tech tycoons know that their social license is wearing thin with the community, and governments are being forced to act. What we've seen this week is just one tiny part, but it misses the broader problem, I think, and the bigger problem. And that is, what is the business model of these companies? Because that's what they're actually into. That's what they're worried about protecting. That's what they don't want governments playing with. And to be perfectly blunt, it's that business model that is actually driving the biggest risk and this kind of viral nature of these horrible posts.
So are you suggesting that companies like X, which is what
Elon Musk is the head of, or other platforms are using the free speech argument to mask what is just a profit-making enterprise.
Absolutely. I mean, the free speech argument is a bit of a red herring, frankly. What they don't want is governments regulating how they use algorithms, how they use individual users' data. I mean, these companies are effectively advertising companies. It's not that we need to regulate individual conversations between users. It's the data from the users that the company sells, that Facebook or Twitter or Google sells to make extraordinary profits, billions and billions of dollars, and then the amplification of particular views through those algorithms. You know, free speech is about, and freedom of expression is a really important principle. And, you know, you and I can have a conversation and express our views to each other. They may be different. That's not what we're talking about when we're talking about regulating social media. We're saying the things that are amplified, the views that are amplified and that cause harm is what, it's that amplification that needs to be regulated. So how it's driven to go viral.
Is that the algorithm question? Is that the first step then that we need to force them to make public how their algorithms work?
Yes. I mean, the extraordinary thing about this is the real driver of their business model is kept secret. There is no transparency. And it's used against and for each of their users. There isn't even protections around the use of children's data and algorithms being used to push content in front of children or minors. I know the Coalition have been talking about, you know, enforcement rules for minors not using social media. I think I'm wary of that. I'm concerned alongside experts that that's not really the safest way of protecting children. What would be safer is to restrict social media companies using the data of minors against the interests of minors by forcing them into these rabbit holes and algorithmic patterns.
So is it the case that we've been doing this a bit piecemeal? We've been looking at particular aspects of these issues as they affect, say, one cohort or, you know, one piece of legislation and not taking a whole of government or a whole of nation view?
Yes, I think this is a big part of the problem. And the eSafety Commissioner and the takedown rules is actually a very narrow part, and it's not the key driver of the issue. It is this business model. It's the amplification, the use of individuals' data. Of course, how this fits into the broader sphere of media regulation. I'm interested to listen to members of the community over the last week as this debate has raged in relation to Elon Musk. And rightly so, a lot of people are saying, well, if you're talking about mis and disinformation, where are the rules and regulations around old media as well? And I think we've got a real problem here. We're in 2024 and our media regulation rules for both old and new and the new paradigm are just not up to scratch and not fit for purpose. We actually need an overview and an overhaul of media regulation across the board, because the platforms by which we access news, whether it is, you know, The Guardian, whether it is the ABC, whether it is the Murdoch Press, is increasingly moving to an online platform, and yet it's not regulated in any of the same way.
So hold that thought for a moment. Before we come to the idea of news media regulation, can we just stick with the platforms for a second? To the point you're making about regulation, it's connected. I went back and looked at the Senate Economics Committee's report from late last year on the influence of international platforms. Now, you weren't a member of the committee, your colleague David Shoebridge was, and it was chaired by Liberal Andrew Bragg, but it looked at everything across the board and how these giant platforms are influencing our community, everything from the child safety point that you make to, you know, artificial intelligence, the impact that it's having across the board, the algorithms, the way they charge for their apps, all of it. And one of the key takeaways from that report was they said no one's really in charge of regulating these platforms in a holistic sense. They pointed to other industries like airlines and banks and even telecommunications companies, and they all have regulatory codes that these platforms don't. The government members on that committee were sort of playing down the findings, saying, look, we've got inquiries, we've got the ACCC, we've got enough measures in place, we don't need to do much. But in light of what we have seen in these past couple of weeks, what do you make of a recommendation that there needs to be some overarching regulatory body targeting the platforms and all of the aspects of what they do, coordinating the work of, say, the eSafety Commissioner, who, as you say, just has a narrow, fairly narrow task and is very busy. What do you think about that? Is that a good idea? And should the government have been doing that already?
Yeah, I think we are, you know, right across the globe, this is happening. Governments are being caught flat-footed. And what's happened is for these platforms, you've got to remember that when Facebook first came along and when Twitter first came along, they saw themselves as disruptors. You know, they were startups and they were disruptors. And now they're effectively monopolies. We are now, 2024, in a space where these platforms are effectively critical infrastructure, right, for the modern world. And in any other space of critical infrastructure, government regulates, they oversee, they protect, they ensure that the public interest is being looked after. And we've got this extraordinary critical infrastructure that is not being governed, and whether it's in a democratic country like Australia or elsewhere. So I do think calls for overarching regulation and a regulator is where things will probably need to go. But governments are so behind the eight ball. And I mean, I was a bit concerned listening and reading comments from Peter Dutton in relation to, you know, this issue around Elon Musk. And now he's kind of backtracking, you know, after being all guns blazing earlier in the week. Now he's saying, oh, well, you know, it's all too hard. For too long, governments have said it's all too hard. And what's going on is the community is seeing now they're experiencing the risks online. They're seeing that this is unfair. They're seeing that even that just the extraordinary amount of money that these platforms make, and they're not even taxed properly, right? Billions and billions of dollars, Australian dollars, you know, flooding overseas into the coffers of Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere, and it's not taxed. And yet this is critical public infrastructure and we need a proper oversight.
Well, we've seen talk of how, you know, maybe the international community should come together, that there should be a wholesale endeavour involving major countries to try and get these tech companies to pull them into line. But don't we strike a problem ultimately with something like the constitutional free speech protections in the United States that end up being a roadblock to action because everyone points to free speech and says we can't rein them in?
Well, I guess that comes back to my point that this isn't about restricting freedom of expression. It's about limiting the harm that the business models of these companies drive. And sadly, it's the shortest path to clicks for these platforms is hate, violence, extremism, conspiracy, lies. And that's why their algorithms push them, because it's the shortest path to clicks. And the amplification of these extreme views, I think people need to understand, come at the cost and the silence of other views. It's not a level playing field. It's a pay-to-play atmosphere where we're operating in here. If you put money behind your post, it's more likely to get up the top of the rank. If you generate outrage, if it's that kind of extremism, you feeds into the algorithm, it goes up the rank. Other views, legitimate views, perhaps information that would be needed in terms of, you know, for a local community or an individual, gets pushed down. So it's not an equal playing field. So it's not about freedom of speech. This is about making sure there are guardrails around how these platforms monetize people's posts, people's views, people's desire for connection.
Well, we talk a lot about corporate social responsibility, but realistically, how do you legislate for corporate social conscience?
Yeah, and I think when you're dealing with individuals like Elon Musk, I think you can understand why people go, oh my gosh, you know, this bloke has no care, no concern, obviously no social conscience. But the EU is doing it. They've just brought in laws over the last 12 months in relation to putting some restrictions around, and it goes right to the heart of the algorithms, making things more transparent, having restrictions around how data of minors is used, that you can't use algorithms to target particular groups of people. Young people is one of them, but it means you can't have targeted algorithms on race, on religious views, a bunch of things, so that people aren't not just targeted, but then targeted and isolated from the views of others. The EU is doing it, and Australia needs to get on board this global push, and we're not doing this alone.
So let's talk more about the media regulation point. I know you've got a bill that's being examined by a Senate committee at the moment. You've spoken this week about trying to haul some of these people, if not Elon Musk personally, then someone representing him and others from other platforms before the committee. What would your bill do, and what would be the point of bringing those people in if you can even do that?
Look, this is about the fact that we need fit-for-purpose media regulation. There is this constant connection between the old media and the new media and players in between, and we just don't have the rules. And I don't think it matters whether you're a tech billionaire like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg or a media mogul like Rupert Murdoch or Kerry Stokes. The public has a right to know and trust the news and information that's posted by trusted sources. It is in the public interest to make sure that we have proper media regulation that delivers quality public interest news to members of the community.
Are we talking about things that are not possible, really? And maybe this goes back to the point about we can't police the entire world. Is there somewhere realistically in between what we have now and the ideal of a properly regulated media industry and across both traditional media and new media that would deal both with the problems we see in the immediate future currently and the problems might be coming down the pipe?
Honestly, when licensing for broadcasters was brought in decades and decades ago, broadcasters didn't want the licensing either, right? There's always been pushback. But when you are offering information and news to the public, there needs to be some legitimacy. There needs to be accountability and there needs to be a social license. And I think there's no silver bullet to this. And I guess that's the point of my regulation Royal Commission is to say, look, we don't have the right rules. It shouldn't be up to politicians, frankly, to do this. I don't think that's a good space. But what our job is to reflect the concerns in the community. And there's certainly concerns in the community that media regulation is not up to scratch, that social media is a free-for-all, that people don't, worryingly, increasingly, don't trust the news that they see, read and hear. And that is bad for democracy. And it is a fundamental threat to democracy if we don't have trusted news sources. So how do we make sure we protect and invest in trusted news sources and ensure that it's accessible to everybody? And that's why we need an overhaul of regulation. And a Royal Commission would be able to do that.
Your Royal Commission proposal originally, though, was just about the Murdoch media, was it not? Like, are you now talking about, was that on reflection too narrow and maybe not fair and now it needs to be broader, or do you think that is still the frame?
To be fair, the terms of reference have always been broader, but yes.
But you called it the Murdoch Media Regulation Bill.
I think upon reflection, I think the community, while they're upset and they distrust the Murdoch media, they're increasingly looking at other players and going, you know, this needs a clean up across the board. And so, you know, maybe it's a reframing, but nonetheless, some type of independent commission to inquire, to test and push the boundaries, to try and have that overarching regulation. It's well and truly over time. And I don't think it's good enough just to go, oh, it's all too hard. Oh, you know, maybe we've missed the boat. Every time government has put in place and parliaments have acted on trying to regulate, particularly in the technology space, it quickly gets out of date because how fast the world transitions. And that's not an excuse for not doing anything.
You've expressed some frustration around the news media bargaining code and the way that's being enforced. So what you're talking about, I guess, with regulation is with a Royal Commission is, okay, let's have it all on the table and see what changes we need to make, what comes to light, what legislative responses we need to improve the situation. But you're also arguing that the government has some powers now that it isn't using. Now, under the News Media Bargaining Code, there's a power of designation, which, as I understand it, if a platform or a company is designated by the government, then that triggers some obligations under the code. Firstly, can you just explain what those obligations would be and why you think they haven't been designating any platforms?
Yeah. So the News Media Bargaining Code was one element to try and deal with some of the need to ensure that there is trusted news on these platforms, but also to ensure that journalists get paid for the work that they do, right?
Yeah, so that was making those big companies pay for every time they put other media's news on their site from journalists, they had to pay for it. And now at least one company is saying they don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah, so Meta and Google struck deals with a number of media companies across the country in here in Australia. This was leading legislation, and Meta have now said they won't renew these contracts. They're not interested. They say it's because the users on Facebook and Instagram aren't interested in news, which I have a real cynicism for. I don't believe that for a second. But what I am worried about is that if they are to block news and links and information from trusted news providers like The Guardian, like the ABC, like the Murdoch Press, like the local newspaper in a small rural town.
Are you calling Murdoch Press a trusted provider now? Hang on a minute.
Well, they are in the terms of, you know, they've got rules and regulations that other that the social media publishers don't.
Right.
There are some decent journalists at News Corp, of course, who do good work, but it's the business model of outrage that I see coming from Murdoch management that worries me the most, and their undue influence. But I digress. I'll come back. The purpose of designation is to say that these companies, Meta, Google, and anybody else that would be designated, would have to pay for the content that they carry, news content that they carry. Pay, you know, it's journalist work. It's being used on the platforms. Users are accessing it, reading it, consuming it. So therefore, as a publisher, those social media companies should pay. The missing point here, though, is that if they're designated under the current law, they're only designated for what they carry. And Meta are threatening, like they've done in Canada, to just not carry news at all. To say, okay, well, we don't want to have to pay for it, so we just won't even, we will ban the sharing of news links. We will deprioritize using their algorithms, pushing down to the bottom news content. And I think that's a real risk. And in the real kind of life exchange, it would mean something like, you might be in a Facebook group and somebody posts a conspiracy theory about something, maybe a conspiracy theory about what happened with the Bondi attacks. Now, rather than being able as a member of that group to post a news story to debunk that myth, you won't be able to do that if Meta banned news sources and news links. So therefore, it just becomes a platform for mis and disinformation, conspiracy, hatred, lies, you know, even more than it is now. And so I think, I know the former ACCC Commissioner Rod Sims is of this view as well, that along with designating these social media platforms to have to pay for the content, the news content, I actually think they need to be designated to carry news in the public interest, because otherwise it will just be a platform of mis and disinformation that can never be debunked by you, me, an individual user, or an organisation.
Is that legally possible to do that?
Well, it's something that I think is worth having a look at how you regulate it. I know other countries around the world are considering these moves.
Wouldn't they say, well, what is news? Who's news?
Yeah, of course. But there are already ways that we categorise this. There are companies that that ACMA, the media regulator, uses to decide who these platforms should pay for their content. There's a number of ways that you could say you're a trusted news source. Facebook should not be able to ban the carriage of your content.
It's an interesting idea. There's a lot more we could talk about in relation to that, but I'm conscious there are other issues in your portfolio areas that I want to ask you about. And can we talk about the terrible incidents of violence against women that we've seen talked about publicly, particularly in the last week or so? Are we having another moment in relation to this issue? Do we keep having moments and then nothing happens? Like, what should the response be to these terrible examples of particularly family violence, but not only family violence? You mentioned the Bondi attacks, you know, all of the victims aside from the security guard who valiantly tried to stop that attacker were women, all the ones who died. Are we having another moment? What on earth should we be doing that we are not?
This is horrendous, isn't it, Karen? I mean, 31 women killed violently this year already. That's more than one a week, often by the hands of their partner or their ex-partner or someone who wished they were their partner. It is just, I mean, this is an epidemic. And it's time we started talking about it, not in terms of just violence against women. This is the murder of women. This is the terrorizing of women in their homes and on the street. Women don't feel safe.
Well, we've heard some debate since the Bondi Junction attacks about whether terrorising is always terrorism and should it be that, and why do we designate other forms of violence as terrorism around certain ideologies when sometimes there's an ideology or a particular view of women that drives mm-hmm. that. And I'm not making that comment in relation to any particular incident involving individuals, but more broadly, is it terrorism? Is it time that we started to change the way we thought about it?
Well, I do think we need to change the way we think about it and the way we talk about it, because what we're doing so far is not working. It is the murder of women. It is the terrorizing of women, and often women and children in their own homes. It's not good enough just to say, oh, to be wringing our hands of it. Like, where is the fundamental kind of all shoulders to the wheel approach to tackle this?
In what way? I mean, we've had many summits, we've had reports, inquiries.
Yes, and women over and over and over again keep calling for and asking for, when are our frontline services going to be funded properly? When are we going to have a guarantee that women won't be turned away when they ask for help? When are we going to ensure that women are protected when they report and even have an ex-partner convicted of something, that they were not able to come after them in revenge? Women have had so many meetings, there have been so many summits, there have been so much heartache, and yet it's still politicians and political leaders wring their hands and say, oh, this is so terrible, it's an epidemic, oh, it's so terrible. I just, where is the overarching prioritisation that this is something that is rife and needs to be tackled? And I'm very concerned, to be perfectly blunt, about the impact, particularly that social media is having on this, that the algorithms, again, I know we've kind of just come off that topic, but I am worried about what is being pushed and promoted, particularly into young men's social media feeds. It is across the board how we tackle this issue. And yet, for some reason, it gets left to the various ministers for women rather than at the top leadership level across all divisions.
I've taken a lot of time talking about social media and media, and we've only just touched on women. I do want to ask you one more question about that, and then let's quickly talk about some environmental issues, which of course are also important to you and generally. What about the issue, before we leave the issue of women, about apprehended violence orders? You talk about adequate protections. They're supposed to protect women. How well do you think they protect women, and do they need more teeth somehow?
Well, they clearly aren't protecting women, and I think the examples, the terrible, terrible examples of the last few weeks are showing that there does need to be a real root and branch review of the justice system for women and the protections in place for them. It's just not excusable. If this was in the health system, if one person a week was dying in the health system because of a lack of infrastructure, a lack of, the kind of systematic problem, heads would roll. Why isn't it being dealt with in the same way? It's time it was. I know there's rallies across the country this weekend. I'll be speaking at the one here in Adelaide. And what I am hopeful, and what gives me some sense of encouragement, is that actually this weekend's rallies are being run by young women. There is a new generation of women coming forward who are sick and tired of the excuses, and they just want to be respected by their peers, and they want others to expect that they should get respected as well.
Well, what's your message to the rally and to the nation?
That we have to have an all-of-government approach to this, and that's why the Prime Minister should declare violence against women a national emergency. Simple. Let's get on with it.
And it will be interesting to see what emerges from those rallies, weekend rallies. Let's briefly talk at least about environmental matters. We saw the Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek, recently make a couple of announcements within her portfolio, creating two environment bodies, Environment Information Australia being one, and an Environment Protection Agency, but also putting off till later some other aspects of reform. What do you make of that? Is it fair enough to say you need more time to work on this?
I think most people who've been in this space and watching it and hoping that the Labor government were going to deliver on their promises are pretty disappointed, frankly. What has happened is the government has announced that they're dumping the commitment to fix the rules. The rules around environmental protection and what is assessed and how approvals are given is really the problem. They're not working. They don't stop the destruction of critical habitat, for example, even let's say koala habitat. They don't stop native forest logging. They don't assess or even think about the impact of projects on the climate, what type of pollution. They don't stop the expansion of new coal and gas. The current laws are failing to protect the environment. And so rather than fixing those laws, that's been put in the too hard basket. It's not going to happen this term of government. The government's dumped that promise and instead of moving ahead with what they're calling a new agency, but really it's basically a new desk inside the department, the Environment Protection Australia. They're going to put a new public servant in, they'll sit on another desk in the department and effectively look at compliance and monitoring. But compliance and monitoring against what are broken rules and ineffective rules. So I'm pretty disappointed. I know lots of people who were really hoping that there was an opportunity to protect the environment properly and to fix these laws are upset. You know, this is going to mean more logging of native forests, more expanding of coal and gas, you know, making climate change worse at a time when we fundamentally have to put the brakes on this stuff if we are actually going to have a chance of halting extinction and stopping runaway climate change.
But Tanya Plibersek says they're just not ready yet, that they need to be done properly. They're not ready.
Yeah, but Karen, the mining industry have been lobbying hard. The big business groups have been lobbying hard. They don't want these laws fixed. And so the Environment Minister's caved in. She's caved in. And what we're going to see is more forests destroyed, more threats to native animals, and more coal and gas pollution.
I want to ask you just finally about greenwashing. I know you have an interest in this issue. There's a Senate inquiry. It had some more evidence in the past week. You've raised concerns about the carbon neutral labelling program. What's your concern about that program? I think it's a program where companies pay to have a carbon neutral label. Is it the paying for it that's the problem? Is it how they qualify? What else?
Overall, greenwashing is becoming a bigger and bigger problem, and governments are having to tackle this.
And by greenwashing, we mean companies coming up with ostensibly environmental measures that are supposed to improve their public reputation but don't do a lot in terms of environmental achievement.
And this is all because the consumer, the public, the individual members of our community can see that we're in an environment crisis. They know that we need to be acting, and they want to be able to make choices themselves about how to help. So when you go to the supermarket and you see on the shelf a product that says it's greener than the product next door, you buy that one because it makes you feel like you're helping the environment. The problem is many businesses and companies are faking it. They're not being honest about how green these products really are. And one of the systems they're using to pretend that they're being greener than they are is a stamp from the federal government under this Climate Active program, which we've discovered through the Senate inquiry just doesn't hit the mark in terms of being environmentally credible. They call it carbon neutral. That in and of itself is a vague and unhelpful term. We're in a crisis, the climate crisis now, where we can't just be carbon neutral. We actually have to stop making pollution and actually reduce the reliance on fossil fuels. Carbon neutral as a tagline just doesn't have any environmental credibility anymore.
So the bar needs to be higher, you're saying?
The bar needs to be higher. And interestingly, through this inquiry, and this is shocking to people to find out, that the ACCC, the regulator, the government regulator who goes in and assesses people's trademarks, whether something's 100% organic or whether it's fair trade, they were asked to assess this climate active stamp from the Federal Environment Department. And they said, the ACCC, that it wasn't clear enough, that the rules by which it was certified were not clear enough, were not up to scratch, and they refused to certify it. So it's not even a certified, properly certified trademark under the ACCC rules. That's concerning in and of itself. I mean, if both two arms of government can't even back each other in, you've got a problem.
Final question here on greenwashing, because we've kept you and chatted a long time, but the very popular program MasterChef is back on the Chen Network now. Their new season is still using gas. It's using gas, but they're talking about it being a cleaner form of gas, I think biomethane and a number of other measures. What do you make of the argument that it's better than other kinds of gas, that at least it's heading in the right direction? I know some critics have called that greenwashing, but isn't there an argument that at least there's progress?
Well, firstly, this biomethane isn't even available for customers, right? So this sponsorship of the gas company providing this type of gas for MasterChef is greenwashing, because all it's doing is promoting the gas company and their brand and giving it a social license. Why do companies greenwash? Because they want a message to customers and to consumers that they're greener than they really are. You can't ring up your gas company and say, oh, I'll have biomethane, thanks, or hydrogen. If the hydrogen that they're using on MasterChef, by the way, isn't even green. It's offset hydrogen. So it's still creating just as much pollution. It's still just as toxic. It's still just as bad. You know, other countries where MasterChef is successful have put induction cooktops onto the show. So in the UK and elsewhere, Denmark, they've got induction cooktops. And it would be much better in Australia for MasterChef to have done a deal promoting induction, because that is where Australian households are going to have to go. It's cheaper, it's cleaner, and the government needs to start helping Australian households electrify their homes. That's where we are going to have to go. Biomethane or hydrogen, even if it's green, are just not available to customers. So it's rubbish. It's a rubbish argument. It's trying to sell the name of the company and give them a bit of a green tinge. It's greenwashing.
Senator Sarah Hanson-Young, so much to talk about. We've covered a lot. There's plenty more we could discuss, but we've got to go. So thanks very much for joining us on Australian Politics.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
This episode was produced by James Milsom. The executive producer is Miles Martignoni. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Support comes from ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. You've heard the hype around AI. The truth is, AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow is the platform that puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/AI for people to learn more.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.